great pleasure
to introduce someone who has been an inspiration to me since the early 1990s when the club was over on Cook Street, Bree Rock.
Hi, I'm Bree, I'm an alcoholic. You guys are so fun. This is where I got sober. My sobriety date is July 15th, 1989. I was 16 years old when I got sober, and it took me almost 2 years of coming in and out to figure out that I was an alcoholic. I'm really glad tonight that there are so many newcomers here. I apologize to those of you who not only have heard my story, but a lot of you have been through it with me. I grew up here. I really, really grew up in these rooms in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got to my first meeting at about, I'm not sure if I was 14 or 15, but somewhere in there. I was sent to an AA meeting by a high school psychologist who happens to be a member of the rooms who still goes to meetings. But some of you in here, I've known all those years, 25 years that I've been sober, and I was thinking, I've got a cold right now. I've got Sudafed going so that I can breathe. The voice has been going out. If I can't make it through this talk, Julie can come up and do it the rest because she knows the whole story. actually, I've kept a journal since I was 11 years old, handwritten journal, and I had two boxes of them. And I didn't want, I mean, all my inventories are in there, everything. I didn't want, if something happened to me, for those to go to my mom or my kids. So they had Julie's name on the box because if anything happened to me, she could take them, and if she read them, she'd know it was all bullshit. So it's really nice to have you here, to have my family here and my friends here. And for those of you that are new to Alcoholics Anonymous, there is a different way of life, and you can have a sober life. I kind of joke that I don't know anything different now. I've been here way too long to know anything other than how to stay sober. And I don't have the kind of story that you hear where people are, you know, they have all the horrible childhood and you wonder, you know, of course they drank, or their drunk log is so crazy that, you know, it's like, wow, it's amazing you ever got sober. I got sober at 16. Most of my life has been sober, and most of what I know is how to work this program through the difficulties of just life. What qualifies me as an alcoholic, and I apologize if I drink. I get tied up in these stupid braces. And sometimes I'm tongue-tied and I can't talk. So, what qualifies me to be an alcoholic is not any circumstance. It's not my parents. It's not where I grew up. It's not anything other than the fact that when I drink alcohol, my body responds to it differently than normal people's bodies respond to it. I have a physical allergy to it, and we hear about that in the doctor's opinion. When I read the doctor's opinion, it's the first time that it made sense to me that alcohol does something different. They call it the phenomenon of craving, that when I take alcohol into my body wants more alcohol. And that early in my drinking, that wasn't so much, but the longer an alcoholic drinks, the worse that gets. And even if we go periods of time without drinking, that physical part gets worse and worse and worse. And I saw that physical part progress in me really quickly. I had my first drink at about 4 or 5 years old with my family. My family, they're drinkers, but they're pretty, most of them pretty much happy drinkers. I still love to hang out with my dad and my uncle when they're drinking scotch and bourbon, and I did this recently. And they drink, they laugh, they joke, they wake up in the morning and apologize for whatever it is they did. And that's the kind of drinking I grew up with. So at about 4 years old, my dad had his big jug of burgundy, and I had my own little wine glass, and I was allowed to, you know, sip off of people's drinks and to have my own little glass of wine. And so drinking was a normal part of life, and it was a good part of life. What changed is then at about 12, 13 years old, I started drinking with friends. You know, not drinking at home, a little few sips. I was drinking, and alcohol did something different for me. I started to have that phenomenon of craving, that when I would drink, I would end up drunk. And I would not really know how it happened or why it happened. But it didn't seem to bother me at first. So I know that I'm alcoholic because I have that craving. you know, regardless of any other circumstances, anything else that happened in my drunkalog, I was able to identify that I don't react to alcohol normally as compared to when my father has a drink and he has a little bit of scotch and it takes him an hour to drink it and he might not finish it and that's all he has. That's not how I drank. One, I didn't need a glass, and when you're 12, 13 years old, you know, in a back alley or the field at school or, you know, that's in somebody's car, that's probably not normal drinking to start with. But I know I had that different reaction, and I understood that when I got here. The other thing that lets me know I'm an alcoholic is that it wouldn't matter if I had the allergy if I never drank alcohol, right? If you're allergic to something but you're never exposed to it, it doesn't matter that you're allergic to it. But here's the tricky part of being an alcoholic. It's this crazy thing in my head that says, I need a drink. You know, to be sent to AA when I was like 14, 15 years old, somebody must have thought that I had a problem with drinking. You know, somebody must have seen that there was something wrong. But for me, drinking felt like what made me work okay, what made me function with people, what made me feel okay. I said I didn't have any kind of like tragic or anything childhood. I don't remember a whole lot about growing up. I've been going through family photos at home now that I've moved back to Santa Maria and I'm helping my dad with the house. I look at the pictures and I see myself and I see the family and I remember looking at the pictures, but I don't remember a whole lot about the events of my childhood. What I do remember is the emotions, the feelings. And a lot of those feelings were grounded in, I don't feel like everybody else, you know? I feel like I'm faking it. I always kind of felt like I was faking it. Like if they knew how I really felt, what I really thought, that I'd be found out somehow someday. You know, even from the time I was little, I just had this sense of something is off with me, and I don't know what it is, and I don't know how to fit in, and I don't know how to do things other people want me to do. And I was always told, you're smart, you're pretty. I was in dance and gymnastics and roller skating and church choir and plays, and I mean, I was doing all those things to be really acceptable on the outside and to show everyone how wonderful I was all the time. I loved to perform. I love to make people laugh. I was really good at showing you how great I was. But it was all because I did not feel okay on the inside, and I was afraid if I wasn't on, then you'd see what was really there. Now, I gave up most of that sports and singing and drama for alcohol when I was 12, 13 years old. And it was kind of like either or. Either I can have a social life and a church life and extracurricular activities, or I can hang out in the back of somebody's truck and drink till I puke. There wasn't really room for, you know, both. Although I did start drinking at youth group. That's really where my drinking took off, was our church youth group. It was a great cover. It was really, really a good cover. Send the good little girl off to Bible, you know, Bible study, but those were some of the partiest people. They really were. My first kiss, my first cigarette, a lot of firsts happened with youth group. But back to this other part of my disease that lets me know that I'm an alcoholic. It's this mental obsession. That little piece of me that never felt like I was okay. When I started drinking, that first time out in the field, it's like seventh grade, and these couple of girls, they'd been my friends, then they wanted to kick my ass, and then they were my friends, and then they weren't. You know, seventh grade. Somehow they asked me to come out in the field with them between classes, and they were passing around a bottle of, you know, the Mad Mix that they'd gotten from their parents' garage. And once I drank with them, everything was good. Everything with them was good. Everything was with me was good. I felt just a sense of belonging and okayness, and that's all I'd ever wanted. Even all those years when I was younger, in dance recitals. I mean, I've been looking back at these pictures of me when I was little and all these little outfits, all these things I did to try and show you how wonderful I was, never made me feel good. They always made me feel pretend. When I drank, I felt real. I felt like my skin fit. And that's just what I wanted. I wanted to be able to be like you and to not feel like I had to hide anymore these feelings. And so drinking worked for me in the beginning. It was a fun thing, and I did have a good time. But like I said, there were some choices to be made. I couldn't do all of those things a good girl is supposed to do and drink. So it's kind of the typical, you know, the choices that we make when we're drinking. You know, these friends are doing their homework and going to school, so they've got to go. I'm going to hang out with these friends where I, you know, walk through campus in the morning, go to the party apartment, hang out with them, roll joints all day, and, you know, just hang out and drink. And eventually, you know, I got kicked out of school. I didn't get in a lot of trouble with the police because at this time, this was like the mid-80s. So for a young teenage girl in the mid-80s, whenever you'd get caught by the police, you cry and you say, I'm sorry, I don't know. And they take you home. And they wouldn't even knock on my parents' door. They would just let me out at the front door. They wouldn't call. I have no idea what they were thinking. I did get arrested once, and it was for malicious mischief or something, and my mom had to come get me, and I had probation and all that. But it wasn't for drinking. It was for just being a dumbass. I can do that sober. There's really not that much to my drinking. I love drinking. I didn't like being sick. I didn't like chasing alcohol down, because that was difficult when you're really young. I didn't like the things that I was having to do to get alcohol because it involved older men who could get alcohol for me. I didn't like the places I was ending up, the people I was with. But there was still this need in me to not be me, and alcohol was a way for me to do it. As I mentioned, I did get kicked out of high school, kind of drop kicked. I stopped going, so they didn't want me back. And it was about my sophomore year. I was only 15, and I was a little too young to go to the continuation school, the independent study school. You had to be 16. So I had 6 months off of school before I could start my new one, and so I just partied. I had fun. I had a really good time. I don't remember it, but I'm sure I had a really good time. And then I started this continuation school, this Delta, which is where I met Julie. And by this time, I'd been in and out of meetings for a while. I'd been sent to AA. I'd sat in a meeting and seen people like you and thought, what am I doing here with you? I don't belong here. But I kind of liked you guys, and I got excused from classes at the time to come to meetings. So I'd been to meetings, and I'd heard about alcoholism, and I knew it was something I really didn't want to have. So I had tried to have these periods of not drinking so that I knew that I wasn't an alcoholic so that I could drink. And this period of school was one of them. I went to continuation school for about 9 months. I did 2.5 years worth of work in that 9 months, and I stayed pretty much sober during that time to prove that I was not an alcoholic and that I did not belong here. And I did. I proved it to myself. I proved it to my family. I was also occasionally coming to meetings and taking chips the whole time, even though I was only occasionally sober. And I had a sponsor. I was kind of, you know, half in and half out. I had this little sober life I was playing with, and then I had my drinking life. And I was trying to do both. And for a little while, that worked. But once I graduated from high school, again, I was 16 years old. It was a year early. I really felt like I proved I'm not an alcoholic because I did what I set out to do. I controlled my drinking. I graduated from high school. I haven't gotten in any trouble. I proved you guys wrong. I can drink now. And that's what I did, and it only took a few months. They talk about the progression of the disease, and for me, it progressed really quickly. I had to drink around the clock. I had a bottle under my bed. I couldn't stay asleep a full night without drinking. And I tried all those experiments of I'll just a little bit of speed and a little bit of pot, maybe no alcohol, maybe a little alcohol, maybe a little speed, maybe a little this, maybe a little that. I didn't get into a lot of drugs, I think mostly because I was not exposed to enough of them. I know now that there are some that I would have liked to have tried, but to me, alcohol is a drug, and the other drugs that the rest of us have used, I really don't see a difference. It's kind of like, oh, well, I only drank beer. Well, I only drank bourbon. It's like, who cares? It's all the same disease. They're different symptoms. I really don't get hung up on that. I'm not going to apologize because there was occasional drug use in my story. If that offends you, then you should probably talk to your sponsor and do an inventory about that. But for me, I did what's in Chapter 3. I tried to control and enjoy my drinking. I tried every means to not be one of you, not be an alcoholic, to not have this allergy, to not have this obsession, because those were the two things that got me. Once I started drinking, I did not know where it was going to stop. I could not remember what I had been doing when I was drinking. I would, you know, I remember coming out of a blackout and I was driving down the street. Now that should kind of scare someone to all of a sudden wake up and you're driving. And to me it just meant I better get back to the party. And that's what I did. So I had this physical reaction to alcohol that had gotten so much stronger, even though for most of that 9 months or so I hadn't been drinking. That physical part had gotten stronger. And the mental part had gotten stronger, because I would still, again, try to have these periods of not drinking. And when I would stay sober a little while, I would start to get really, really uncomfortable. I would just, my skin would crawl, you know. I could play pretend that I was happy to be sober for a little while, and I could tell you what you wanted to hear for a little while, and I could quote the book for a little while. But there was always this discomfort in me that just wouldn't go away. Now, along the way, and my story is just not that, there's nothing really fantastic in it. There's all the typical stuff that, you know, that women go through in being young, and all the things that we, you know, derive our guilt and shame from that I needed to work through. And those things that we do when we're drinking that, you know, later we feel guilty about. You know, how could I ever have slept with him? And how could I have, you know, said that about her? My problem was, when I got sober, my behavior was just as bad, only I couldn't blame alcohol. And that was kind of a wake-up call for me, that the problem was really me. It wasn't the alcohol. The alcohol was the solution for a long time. I want to jump into what actually got me back into the rooms and sober, and then I'd really like to spend some time talking about my life sober, because that's where I spent most of it, is sober. So I had this heavy period of drinking after high school, because I'd proved I wasn't one of you. And like I said, I'd been taking chips, I had a sponsor, and I also like geographics. I love to just get in the car and go with whoever I could go with and end up wherever I could end up. And I had a little truck and I had a tent, and I would just go. I would still do that today if I could get away with it. I've thought about it. I actually was looking at tents last night with Julie. I would just try to run away all the time. And on this last time of running away with a guy and partying actually with that uncle that I was talking about and some other friends, my mom had just had enough, and she called me and she was like, you're coming home, I've got you a job, you're straightening out. And up to this point, my parents had never put their foot down with me. They were afraid that if they told me no and if I ran away, they would never see me again. And so they always wanted to keep the door open, and they wanted to know where I was, and they'd rather make sure that I had a car, you know, and make sure that I had gas, and make sure they, I really don't know what to say about it, because on one hand, they're extremely enabling, and on the other hand, hell, I got sober at 16, so I can't fault them either way. But my mom told me to come home, and I did. I drove home, because I'd been having a miserable time out there trying to control and enjoy and not doing either. I came home. First place I went to was the party house, the party apartment, of course. And I ended up down at the billiards lounge. I love to play pool. And I ran into a guy there that I'd seen in meetings, and he asked me how I was doing, and I don't remember what I told him, but he said, well, meet me at the Alana Club tomorrow, and we'll go out, we'll go hang out. Okay. So the next day, about 5 o'clock or so, I went down to the Alana Club. He wasn't there. He stood me up, but there was a meeting, and I think he had just tricked me into going to a meeting. But before the meeting started, there was a guy named Ron there, Biker Ron. Some of you remember him. And I sat with him and talked, and he asked me how long I'd been sober. And somehow, magically, the truth came out of my mouth, which was very rare. I said, today, because I haven't found anything yet. And he was like, oh, I thought you had about a year. I said, no, I don't. He said, well, why don't you stay for the meeting? And I stayed. It was not my intention to get sober. I was going to meet somebody there to go get drunk, not get sober. I don't remember anything for about 4 days. I guess I kept going to meetings. It was almost like coming out of a blackout, but I was in a meeting. And I'm sitting there, and I thought, okay, I'm in a meeting, and I'm sober, and it's been 4 days. All right, well, I'll just stay in the meeting, and I'll make it today. And the next day, it was another meeting and another day and another meeting and another day. And it wasn't where I wanted to be. And I, like I said, I still had a sponsor, and she thought that I was coming up on a year. So by the time I hit 30 days, what I did was we came to the Friday night meeting here where they give out chips, and we sat at that back table. And I sat where Francisco is, and my sponsor was sitting back there. And when they said anyone for 30 days, I jumped up all excited and came and took a 30-day token. And then I went back and sat down, and her jaw was just like, I thought you had a year. I'm like, no, I have 30 days. I wasn't really good at being honest or upfront about anything, but I figured if everyone was cheering that I had 30 days, then she couldn't be mad at me, you know. So that's how I told my sponsor. My parents accidentally found out because they thought I was sober. I told them things like, I'm the designated driver. That's why I'm going to that party. And I had, I love to have, I love to cook. I love to cook. And I've done this since I was a very young teen, cooked big meals and had people over. And I was having a little dinner party. My parents didn't care. I was cooking. I had Hippie Bob and Mike over for dinner. And Bob said something about, not bad for a newcomer. And my parents went, what? By the way, I'm sober again. But fortunately for me, that's been the last time I've had to break it to my parents that I'm sober again or anybody else. I've stayed sober, and the first few months it was that whole pink cloud. Like, yay, I'm sober, I feel great, I'm so happy to be here, you know, little AA cheerleader. And I had a tight group of friends that were young people, and we hung out together all the time, playing cards all night, going to the coffee shops, going to the pool hall. We were just together all the time, and we were having a lot of fun. Some of them were starting to get into this program, though. They had sponsors, they worked steps, and I had my sponsor, I moved to Reno with her, and she left me there with a drunk guy. So we weren't really working a program. I wasn't doing what everybody else was doing. I was just doing the fellowship. I was just coming to AA and doing what I'd always done. I was sober. And everybody loved me because I was cute, and I was young, and I was here, and I just played that for everything it was worth. But I was getting more and more miserable, that ick feeling inside, you know, that they're going to find out. that I'm not really an alcoholic, I'm just pretending, and then they're going to throw me out. All of that started, and I had, you know, a boyfriend, and he was lying, and it was all his fault, and, you know, I'm trying to complain about other people and what they were doing in my life, but finally somebody sat me down and told me that the problem was not him and it wasn't these other people, that the problem was me, and that if I wanted to stay sober, I needed to get into these steps. And that's what we did. We sat down and we started going through the doctor's opinion and Bill's story. And, you know, I'd read a lot of this stuff before, but it didn't really click with me. I mean, what do I have in common with a stockbroker from 1935? Really, nothing. Nothing at all do I have in common with Bill Wilson or anyone else of the founders of the AA or anybody else in here. I mean, you guys are talking about losing jobs. You're talking about DUIs, going to prison, you know, all this stuff. I have no idea what you're talking about. I just didn't have a story that compared at all. And so if we were going to look at outside circumstances and things that you lost and things that you did and adventures that you had, I couldn't be one of you. But when I dug into that doctor's opinion, when it was pointed out to me that to me drinking seemed normal, that I'm restless, irritable, and discontent when I'm sober, and that when I drink, I get a sense of ease and comfort. That's an alcoholic, and that was me, exactly. And I would do whatever I needed to do to get that sense of ease and comfort. That's the mental obsession. It's that need to feel like I can breathe, because left to my own devices, I feel like I can't. And the problem then is that once I have a drink, there's that allergy, and I don't know where I'm going. So I found myself in that book, and I actually found myself in Bill's story as we went through it. And you see, there are just points in there, like when, you know, he says fear sobered him for a bit. I mean, there are just little blips in there that hit me, and I'm like, yeah, I've had that. I've stayed sober on fear before, for a little while. And it does. It keeps you sober for a little while. But eventually, you know, it wasn't that bad. And it'll be different this time. And the fear gets a little less. And the need to feel different gets a little more. Things like him just, God, all of it floating through my head. I finally, that night that I had this, people with the same amount of time as me, but a whole lot more program, when they took me through those couple of chapters, I realized I was an alcoholic, that I could not deny it on the basis of what an alcoholic really is. When you honestly want to, you can't quit entirely, or if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, you're probably an alcoholic. On those grounds, I could not deny it, that I was an alcoholic. Anything else, I could. My age, my experiences, the circumstances. I mean, yeah, I could quit drinking for a while. I stayed stopped long periods, near relative to my age. But it sank, and I knew I was one of you. And it was kind of a, on one hand, I was relieved to know what the problem was. I mean, never mind, I'd been in meetings for 2 years or so having people tell me what alcoholism was and that was the problem. It's like it took it that long for it to sink. I'm an alcoholic. And on the other hand, it was terrifying because the only solution that we found, according to the book, for this mental obsession is a spiritual one. It's to be relieved of that mental obsession, to have a psychic change. And that requires belief in a higher power, turning your life and will over to this higher power, and that's where I was totally screwed. I was raised with a God. I was raised in a very strongly religious family, and I had very strong religious ideas. I actually spent most of my childhood wishing Jesus would come, take me, because I was really done. And I knew I could never live up to what that God wanted. So for me to have to trust this God to get me sober when I'd already done everything I could wrong was just impossible. but there was a saving statement there that as we understood him, and they told me, you don't have to have that God. And I realized everything that I knew about God could be absolutely wrong, that people told it to me, and people can be wrong. So everything I know could be wrong. Absolutely everything. And that was my moment, really, of open-mindedness and of being willing. And I got a sponsor. I started working the steps, and I got really, really into the big book and into some book studies that were pretty cool at the time. That's when I got sober. I do want to tell you some about what life has been like sober, like I said, because most of my life has been sober. I really didn't know what to do. The first few years, I tried college. I took a full load of classes and tried to work full time. And I lost the job and I failed all the classes. And so I took a break. And the next year I did the same thing in college and school. And I screwed it all up in the next year. So three times I flunked out of Hancock. And so I decided to give that up, and I got pregnant. I knew how to do that. I've never shared this at the podium, but for some reason I just feel like it. A lot of you know my son, Tyler. He's 21 now, and Meg would probably get real mad. He was actually conceived in a van outside the Alano Club. So, I was, my behavior early sobriety was not unlike my behavior drinking. I just recently found pictures of his dad. We were together about a year and a half, and he was sober, and then he got drunk, and he's been out of our lives the rest of the time, but I didn't know what to do with myself the first few years, several years sober. I mean, I was just floundering. I had no idea what I wanted to be when I grew up, or if I wanted to grow up, or how do you do this sober? Just no clue. And I felt like I'd already screwed up my whole life. I mean, when you've already gotten drunk and sober by 16, and you screwed up and flunked out of college three times, I mean, where do you go from there? You get pregnant. And I got pregnant, and then my son's father got drunk and left, or he left and got drunk. He took the money out of my wallet, he was gone, and so I was a single mom, moved back in with my parents, and had my son, and something really magical happened when he was born, because suddenly I had a purpose. It was like I didn't know how to take care of me, but then I had this little life, and I knew I can take care of him. That I can do. And I kind of got my shit together from there. By the time he was two, I was working, and we had our own apartment, and then I met someone in the program, Anna, who had a teenage daughter at the time. She was 10 years younger than me. That was fun. I was 23. I was 23 years old, and she was 13 when her dad and I got married. My son was two. I got pregnant with my daughter, Genevieve. I found out I was pregnant a week after we got married. So that was quick. And I thought I was putting together this happy little AA life with my little sober husband. Oh, he wasn't little. My big, you guys know Ken. With my sober husband and my children and this wonderful white picket fence of sobriety. And it wasn't like that at all. Not to share their stories, but there were issues. And they revolve around what happens with this disease to a father, to a daughter, to children in the midst of it. And I spent 7 years married to Ken, trying to raise these children. We moved to San Diego, and life was really, really hard. My stepdaughter went through a lot. She was in and out of mental institution, a drug addict. She's got it. She's just got it, what we have. And it was difficult having small children and trying to keep them safe in a house that for a lot of reasons was not safe. But I ended up in San Diego because Ken got a job down there. And this was in 2000 that we moved down there. And by that time, I started going to school again, actually somewhat successfully. After a few years of raising small children, doing daycare. I needed something that was mine, and I decided to go back to school. And I loved it, and I did really well. So I kept going, and I got grants and scholarships and found childcare, and I just kept going, and I held on to that. And when Ken and I got divorced, I stayed in San Diego, and I kept going to school. I raised my kids on campus. I homeschooled them, took my daughter with me to school. I'd be in the library in class, and she'd be across from me studying, and school was just a really good, wonderful place for me to be, and it felt like something that was mine, and something I really wrapped my identity around a lot, and I had a lot of support. I'm the first one in my family to go to college, and I've been really proud of that. And a lot of you have supported me through that for a long time. But there have been some bumps in the road along the way with that, too. I mean, a lot of you know my my son. He's been in and out of rehab since he was 15. My daughter has had her own struggles and been in and out of the hospital over the years. And then a few years ago, well, a few years ago, I came back up to Santa Maria from San Diego, and I ended up taking care of my mom because she had brain cancer. And I lived up here for a couple of years and took care of her. I took a leave of absence from school and took care of her. I stayed with my dad and helped him. And I gave up that dream of school. At that time, well, I already had two bachelor's degrees and two master's degrees and was working toward the PhD. But I took a leave of absence and took care of mom, and I decided I didn't need the PhD. That's okay. You know, it's like I've been there long enough. I have a total of 15 and a half years of school right now. And I was really glad to be there to take care of my mom and to be loved by this community, this family, sober. It took a lot of inventory for me to be able to take care of my mother. I didn't mention a whole lot about her, but she was a difficult woman, a severely abused child who never found any kind of recovery. She didn't drink, but she could have used one. And by the end of it, I had total peace with her. The last time that I was feeding her, just a couple of weeks before she passed, I realized this is kind of the last moment that I'm going to have with a mom who can look at me and talk, and even though she didn't make sense. And I appreciated her. Actually, I'm finally able to wear jewelry that was my mom's. The ring is something my dad bought for my mom in Brazil on their second honeymoon, which is where I was conceived. And the earrings I bought for my mom one Christmas with my dad's credit card, but I bought those for her, and it's taken me a couple years of healing to be able to be in touch with my mom things. So sorry to sidetrack there, but I was ready to not, I had accepted that I wouldn't go back to school, and my father said, no, you're going back. You're going to finish, and I'm going to support you. And I did find a way to get back to San Diego. I don't know how I was able to do it, but I spent the last year and a half back there making up my missed classes, doing all of my internships. I've gotten to something called ABD, which is all but dissertation status. And I've been writing proposal after proposal trying to get this dissertation going. And now where I am right here this moment today is that I've moved back to Santa Maria. Because this last year or so, I've had migraines that are so severe that I can't write my dissertation and I can't work and support myself. And I've been stubbornly, because I'm really stubborn, I've been trying to just stay down there and do what I need to finish school. I need to take care of, my daughter got off to college, I'm trying to keep her in college. I need to take care of everybody. I need to be the strong one. And I ended up being absolutely more broken than I've ever been in my whole life. 25 years sober, and I've got to a point that was way more broken because there was way more to break. When I got here at 16, I didn't have enough of me yet to be as broken as I got to be in the last few months, the last real recent. And I've been getting help. There have been wonderful people here who love me and help me and are trying to help me get healthy. And my full-time job right now is get healthy. The PhD is off the table. I lost my funding. I don't have any income. I'm living with my dad. He's happy to have me, and I'm happy to be with him. And there's a purpose there. I am absolutely loved and supported, and I'm in a totally new place in my life. I have no idea what I'm doing from here at all, other than I'm staying sober. Any day without a migraine is a good day. And any day that I get to share my sobriety, share my spirit with you, I'm really grateful for. I have a tendency to give of myself until there is nothing left of me. But when I do this, when I stand in front of you and just let it go, one, I never know what you're going to get. but this fills me up. This gives me energy and power that otherwise I wouldn't have access to. And I'm trying to distinguish, I'm trying to learn the difference between giving that takes my energy and giving that gives me energy. I've not been real good at knowing the difference and being able to give in a way that is good for everyone, not just good for you. So that's where I am right now. I'm finally grateful to be here. When I got here a couple of weeks ago and people would say, how are you? I'd like, I'm here. Not happy about it. And you all are like, well, we're happy to have you. So I really appreciate that you've been able to love me even when I'm not lovable and to help me when I don't want your help and I refuse and I'm fine and to get me through it. Thank you for being here tonight, especially to those of you who have heard me way too many times. Because the story doesn't change. I mean, you know, it's not much of the end. Otherwise, you're stuck with me. Thank you very much. I appreciate you all.
Thank you, Bree, for speaking tonight. Thank you to everyone who has a commitment at this meeting. Let's give Bree one more.